30 minutes of the seminar. So Paul, if you give me a second, I will bring up your presentation. And you can go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much and welcome everyone and thanks for tuning in. First of all, I'd just like to say that the material that I'm presenting today has been pulled from the new NHI course 139003, Advanced Freight Planning. So that course is now currently available on the NHI website. So again, the presentation material is just a sampling of some of the in-depth supply chain and freight planning material covered in that Advanced Freight Planning course. So for the agenda today, we're going to start off with talking about the major trend in freight logistics and really breaking that down mode by mode. We'll continue our discussion and by giving an overview of supply chain basics and then talk about the implications for planning. How do planners for the public sector really use this information and to integrate the freight needs and concerns into the transportation planning process? So to start off again talking about the trends in logistics, we'll break it down mode by mode and talk about the trends in trucking. The modes handling most of the nation's service freight are under significant pressure, and trucking productivity is being challenged by many factors, including labor factors and increased congestion. And at the same time that they're being challenged with productivity and congestion, the costs are also rising. For safety, for a lot of safety reasons, the USDOT changed the hours of service and regulations for truck drivers in 2004. This had some significant implications for the trucking industry. The key change in that regulation is that drivers can now run 11 hours instead of 10, but the rest periods can't be used to break up the work shift. So what this ultimately means is that if a driver is waiting around for a customer or waiting in between pickup and delivery, that driver is effectively still on the clock. So this can have a significant impact on productivity for the trucking industry. Meanwhile, traffic congestion continues to grow in all of the major cities, and this congestion is also beginning to spread into the inner city lanes. And what this equates to is more time for truckers sitting in traffic. Every minute lost in traffic equates to lost productivity. There are lots of estimates out there. One of the most commonly used estimates is the cost of delay for a truck driver is $75 per hour, which is over a dollar a minute. And of course, this is going to vary based upon geographic regions and the type of pickup and deliveries, long haul versus some of the drayage drivers. But regardless, the congestion and delay impacts everyone within the trucking industry. The importance of this is highlighted by the realization that the driver wages typically are the biggest expense for motor carriers. Moreover, wage levels have been slowly climbing, but never enough to really offset the driver turnover due to long working hours and too much time spent away from home. So what ultimately this is, this is resulting is that the demand for drivers is well above the supply, and driver shortage is one of the biggest issues facing the trucking industry. As public planners, you should care about this for two reasons. First of all, trucks handle about 80% of the nation's freight tonnage. That's higher in some geographic areas, a little lower in others, but on average nationwide it's 80%. And it will take on more than 80% of the new tonnage over the next few decades. This means that the health of the industry is important to the economic well-being of our nation. And secondly, the public policy and public action can and do affect the productivity and overall driver satisfaction in the trends. Again, productivity, congestion, and input cost factors that are all impacting the trucking industry. So fuel costs, a lot of discussion about fuel costs, and definitely we're feeling it as passengers, but it's also really hitting hard the trucking industry. And it's become a material burden for all freight modes, but are especially significant for trucking. And if costs continue to climb, there will be consequences for how goods are handled, and ultimately what we're already seeing is consequences in the consumer prices. The graph here on the screen just shows the diesel fuel prices, which in recent years have climbed significantly. This goes through the second quarter of 2006. And so we know that already 2007 and 2008 that we continue to see those prices climbing and oftentimes on a daily basis hitting new records. So higher fuel costs are really causing shippers to begin to look for alternatives, including modal shifts and redesigned supply chains, both of which change freight demand patterns, which are going to change the way in which freight transportation impacts our public transportation systems. So with this, a lot of times, again, the trends in one mode or the trends impacting one mode are going to spill over and impact other modes. And that's definitely true in terms of the impact of trucking and the spillover into the trends in rail freight. Rail might be an outlet for some motor carriers. If it had room to grow, it can meet service standards. While the truck rail intermodal business is thriving, there are big question marks on the capacity and the ability of the rail nation's rail system to actually be able to handle all of the trucking freight that might ultimately want to divert over to the rail system. In response to productivity pressures on the trucking industry, some motor carriers are looking to free up driver time and reduce costs by putting loads onto the intermodal rail. The reason is that rail is 10 times more fuel efficient per ton mile than highway transport, and some truckers have found that the rail service is more profitable than over-the-road services they're currently providing. If the nation moves more widely to toll roads, this differential could widen even. Meanwhile, the rail intermodal business has been growing at an average rate of 6% per year, which means that rail is keeping a great deal of new volume off the roads. But a big part of the issue for the rail is that the network reduction that the industry undertook over several decades in terms of abandoning lines and selling off lines has left them with a capacity crunch, especially for the fast intermodal trains that need more track space. So railroads have been responding with investments, but they've been using prices to also allocate capacity as well. Sometimes this is referred to demarketing. They will demarket less profitable lines by increasing the prices and therefore making trucking more competitive relative to the rail, simply because they know that they're going to have lower profit margins on those particular lines. This is important to public planners because new traffic may be coming onto the highways because railroads no longer have room for it, and it really opens the door, and the need for public-private partnerships may actually be the answer to get some of the necessary investments in rail. And we've seen that on a national level. We've seen it in a lot of local areas, but we've also seen that on the national level. One of the, of course, the Alameda Corridor has been talked about a lot. The new development is also with the Heartland Corridor that is going from Norfolk, Virginia up to Columbus, Ohio. And again, that's public-private in terms of local, state, port, railroad money, but also federal dollars as well. So in terms of waterborne freight, some of the major trends here you'll see listed, marine transportation due to increasing size of vessels places high demands on the infrastructure because, again, they get to the ports, but still depends upon the intermodal movement either by rail and our truck to actually get it to the final market. A number of strategies have been developed to address marine capacity issues, but capacity is not the only issues facing waterborne freight. There's also a lot of environmental issues as well as labor issues. To appreciate the effect of increasing sizes of ships, consider that a 6,000 TEU, which is a 20-foot equivalent unit, container ship represents 3,000 trucks loading in one place in less than a week. Shuttling of empty containers and truck chassis results in an even greater number of truck movements in the port area. So again, these port facilities, and especially those that are going to be handling the mega ships, are going to be huge traffic generators on our surface transportation system. PurePass is a good example of a public policy response to the need for increased port capacity, and this is implemented at the ports of LA and Long Beach, where the dock crews were not working in evening shifts. PurePass was a way to change to charge money for daytime operations, or to charge a cost to charge a premium for daytime operations, which acted as an incentive for port terminals to add a night shift. So 30 to 35% of the container cargo moved to evening and weekend hours in the first year of operation, which was 2005 to 2006. Thereby, it increases the throughput. Plus, it helps to spread out the demand for truck traffic on the roadway system. So usage of all water routes has also contributed to a shifting of some of the capacity burden from West Coast to East Coast ports. This started to occur due to port congestion in the 2002 West Coast port strike, as well as the supply chain strategies of big box retailers. The all-water routes tend to replace transcontinental rail land bridge shipments from west to east coast ports. And so again, this whole concept of the all-water routes, and as we have the expansion of the Panama Canal, which is underway, as that continues, as well as expanded use of the Suez Canal, you'll see more of those all-water routes. And again, some of the shifting of some potential growth in freight from the west coast ports over to the east coast ports. Transloading is the third trend that's noted on the slide here, and it involves the transfer of goods from international containers to bigger domestic trailers or containers. There are really two issues here, two catalysts for this transloading. First are the retail supply chain strategies that seek to respond better to the point of sale data and to consolidate international with domestic freight. Second is the move by container ship lines to keep their boxes close to the port by reducing free time and charging more for use. The fourth trend noted on the slide is short sea shipping, which is the domestic waterborne shipment of containerized goods as a substitute for highway transport. So according to the private studies by potential operators, the best short sea prospects are in dense lanes of 800 miles or more, most of which lie along the coast are within the Great Lakes region. Obstacles to the development include the high cost of U.S.-built vessels, again going back to the Jones Act, which are required to be used in domestic waterborne trade. So again, while there's lots of interest in short sea shipping, I think that we do have to recognize that there are limitations in terms of how extensively it can be used as a congestion mitigation for landside transport. And just to talk very briefly about the trends in pipeline transportation is used primarily for moving natural gas and petroleum products from areas of production to areas of consumption. In some areas, water transportation complements or competes with pipeline transport for these commodities. Some of the primary trends are the key trends impacting pipelines are weather risk. And again, a serious or recent or future concerns, changing weather patterns and kind of the climate change impact on transportation has been a big issue of national research and discussion the past year. Pipelines are not immune to this. For example, Hurricane Katrina shut down some petroleum pipelines for several days in 2005. And of course, with the weather trends and everything, the concern is that this is going to become a reoccurring trend, especially on the Gulf Coast. A second issue that's really impacting pipelines is the growing demand for ethanol and other biofuels. Some existing pipelines can be converted to handle this product, which would otherwise move by water or rail, but it takes time and money. So the rise in fuel prices we talked about will affect the demand for ethanol and practical ways to transport it. Trends in air cargo. Again, air cargo represents, in terms of total tonnage, the smallest component of transport, but it is the fastest growing, and in terms of value, it tends to carry our highest value goods. But it does really depend upon high performance standards, because typically these things are critical items of high value, and so time and reliability are some of the key needs in terms of air cargo. And given some of the deficiencies within our air cargo, within just our overall air infrastructure, there are some concerns with the ability and the continued growth in air cargo for it to be able to meet the supply chain needs. So the great reliability and fast transit times of air freight make it the leading edge for high performance logistics. Although its physical volumes are light, it's big in value terms, and many of the airborne goods are critical to keeping supply chains running. And of all the big air freight carriers, are typically global operators. However, as trucks have become better able to provide time-definite service and as fuel costs have risen, domestic shipments that in the past may have flown are now using ground transportation. For example, a lot of our express carriers, FedEx and UPS, are now shipping some of the packages that traditionally may have gone on air cargo via overnight shipments on our highway system. So public planners should care about this because local businesses may, for example, want longer runways to support international flights for all cargo flights. And they're going to need good air and ground connections to the airports again, talking about the multimodal connections. It comes in via air cargo, but ultimately it's got to move to its final destination via truck. So trends in logistics really help to shape the economic geography and the operating requirements for freight. And so with this slide, we're going to start to look at those things that really start to impact the functioning of supply chains. Visibility is a logistics objective signifying the ability, ideally, to see and affect any item in real time anywhere in the supply chain, at the factory, the warehouse, the store, or aboard the freight carrier. Shipment tracking is a critical part of seeing where items are in the supply chain. And again, that's a very important component in terms of supply chain management. Shipment tracking involves a combination of technology, which can be transponders, cellular devices, barcodes, radio tags are all examples of technology. It also combines data processing and communication systems, including web-based platforms for shippers to tap carrier data, and operational controls like satellite tracking of tractors and trailers. So not only does this help in terms of overall management of supply chain, but it also adds safety and security measures, which are very important to carriers, but shippers as well. Another big trend is really globalization, and international trade has become a primary component of the U.S. economy, and this is driven in large part by import growth. Foreign trade now exceeds one quarter of the GDP. This graph shows that imports and exports now exceed one quarter of our total economy, and projections are that it's going to continue to rise. Both exports and imports are growing, but imports began to outstrip exports in the 1980s, and the gap has widened since the new century began. Effectively, U.S. foreign trade is replacing volume or growth in domestic production. So basically what we're saying here is that the projections are that by 2020, that the trade-based employment is going to comprise a major component, or the most significant component, of the U.S. employment picture, replacing manufacturing. So in the end, I mean, I think this comes to no surprise to everyone, but the U.S. is moving and becoming a trade-based economy as opposed to a production-based economy. And this has significant implications for our transportation system. It's always been important in terms of supporting the economic activity and the economic base, but with regards to trade and the emphasis on supply chain management, it's become even more important for economic competitiveness. So with that, we're now going to move into the section where we start talking more specifically about the supply chain basis and how all of these trends are impacting really operations down at a firm-by-firm specific level. We'll start by talking about logistics and comparing traditional logistics to what we're starting to see more and more of today. There are two key changes to recognize in logistics. One, how the structure of the business enterprise has changed, and secondly, how the methods of control have changed with it. In the traditional structure, material ownership was the principal method of control. So this is going to be the first of two slides. This one shows the traditional structure for goods movement. The traditional structure really relied on an integrated business model, pushing goods out from manufacturers to stores. It's a top-down supply chain process where materials flow from an integrated manufacturer to customers at the end of a supply chain. This is a push system in which goods production is scheduled and shipped to stores based on predictions of customer sales. So now consider the method of control for this type of system. In the traditional system, control relied on having inventory on hand throughout the supply chain stages of distribution, which are shown at the right-hand side of the slide. The method of control did not rely very much on information systems, which in any case were not digital and were far from real time. So transportation had an important but not a primary role, and typically it was not performing with just-in-time precision because you had a stock of goods sitting on the warehouse shelf, either at the back of your retail establishment or somewhere within a nearby warehouse or distribution center. So again, goods were produced and then pushed out to the retail level in your traditional logistics system. What we're seeing today and what we've seen the evolution of over the past decade or so has been fast cycle logistics. And again, here we are moving to the contemporary system of fast cycle logistics. Look first at the key at the lower left hand, which now has a component for information flow, and that's shown in red, as well as for material flow, which is shown in white. Now, consider the new look of the business structure as of right, which has become more complex and has two directions. Starting at the top, the supply chains have become far-flung around the world. And so notice that we have global locations right there at the top. Now, look at the integrator there and the position of the integrator. The integrator is a company that really ties everything together. Oftentimes, this is in the form of a third-party logistics company, a 3PL. But the key players today really are the modern retailers who increasingly dictate the design of the products which are sold within their store. A prime objective in this system is to rely on point-of-sale information to really drive the ordering and production in as close to real-time as possible. And this is called pull logistics, which means that the actual sales pull the products through the chain instead of doing longer-term forecasts and producing the basis of that forecast and having it ready-made and stocked on the shelf. They're really waiting until as close to the point to where it's being sold and it needs to be restocked as possible. The goal is to have exactly the right kind of product ready for purchase at exactly the right place and moment with no lost sales and no excess inventory. So this really helps the company in terms of tightening up their cash flow. They're not taking ownership of products and spending that money until they know that they actually need it and are going to be able to sell it and get the revenue. So again, the efficiency of the supply chain really is a cash flow management tool for businesses today. All of this is enabled by information technology, and it's really the fusion of information technology and transportation which has enabled this movement towards fast cycle logistics. And the whole complex system exemplifies the absolutely essential need for the visibility principle that we just discussed previously. So, if you look here now, looking at the method of control, we'll also notice changes within the method of control. The term fast cycle logistics refers to the replacement of inventory with information and high performance transportation, as can be seen in the pie chart here. It's also known as just in time, as well as other names. To sum it up, when you look at the supply chain flow chart, you're looking at the way businesses are organized. All of the transportation and information linkages are joining together parts of the enterprise. And when the transportation system doesn't work right, when it's slow or unreliable or imprecise, then the business itself is underperforming. And in a global market, underperformance makes our businesses uncompetitive. So what exactly is supply chain management? We've thrown that word out some. But now, when we look at supply chain management, it really... freight transportation performance drives supply chain functions, which in turn influence economic development. In the old system, inventories were held in stock rooms and distribution centers. They were shipped in stocks prior to customer demand. The transportation activity had no real value except to get products to the consumer. In today's supply chain, the transportation vehicle is serving as the moving warehouse, which allows shippers and receivers to reduce inventory carrying costs and places more emphasis on the performance of the transportation system. This has led to an increase in logistics industry employment and the creation of third-party logistics firms to manage the supply chain process. Time performance is behind everything. If you don't have the goods on hand, you need to know where they are and be able to get them when needed. Just-in-time business models have replaced inventory levels with transportation. Trucks and rail cars are new warehouses. Time delays hurt shippers and carriers, and in particular, they hurt the shippers through the carriers. Mm-hmm. So time delays, and more important, variability in travel times harm carrier productivity because they drag down the utilization of freight carrier assets, which are their equipment and their people. Poor turnaround is costly in terms of return on assets, access to capital, and retention of drivers. All of this has an impact ultimately on consumer prices and overall level of economic activity within a region. So with this, I'm going to talk just briefly about what are some of the key transportation requirements of different major industrial sectors. For advanced manufacturing, again, these are the industries that rely on just-in-time and have really been kind of mainstreaming the whole supply chain management in the integration of the information with transportation. And the transportation requirements for advanced manufacturing, which would include electronic manufacturing or automotive manufacturing, aircraft, biomedical type manufacturing. manufacturing, is that it has to be reliable and timely. They want time-definite deliveries because they are holding very low inventory. For example, I interviewed some folks at Nissan plants throughout the country, and on some of their parts, they hold as little as 2 hours worth of inventory on hand. And so reliability is really crucial, because if they miss those parts, then it could mean shutting down a production line. It's also characterized by higher value of shipments. And again, this is to the reliability and timeliness is to support the just-in-time manufacturing. And you typically see that these are really multimodal. They'll depend on air cargo to a certain extent, but also rail, really all of the modes. But they also tend to be truck-dominant because, again, trucking can provide some of the most reliable forms of surface transportation. For natural resource manufacturing, again, this is characterized typically by bulky goods. They tend to be low damage, but low cost goods, so there's not as much focus on damage. And there's also typically a little less emphasis on speed because they are bulky. They know that it can be costly to transport them, so they're willing to give up some of the emphasis on the speed to get a lower cost per ton mile. Typically, you'll see in natural resource manufacturing, they tend to be rail and barge dependent. Again, a lot of times the last mile may be handled by trucks. For non-durable manufacturing, again, this is a lot of our consumer goods that we see, and they tend to be heavy or high Q. And again, what we mean when we say high Q is that they tend to, when terms of trucking, and you know, we all have truck size and weight limits, and typically what we see a lot of times with non-durable manufacturing is that they will cube out, or they will fill the physical space of a truck before they really reach the weight limit there. They typically have moderate to high value, and the shippers are typically concerned with moderate to high speed, again, getting things to the market and not having inventory stock out. These are also characterized by local ends of long supply chains, and so you're going to have different patterns in terms of the overall manufacturing and production, and then you're going to have local ends in terms of the distribution of these goods to local retail outlets. And again, non-durable manufacturing, the transport of these types of goods, typically truck dominant. For service industries, and service industry is very important. When we're talking service industries, it's not just your eating establishments and hotel and lodging, but also the high value professional services in terms of financial services, but healthcare services and educational services as well. And this is a growing part of our economy, one of the fastest growing parts of our economy. But they also have freight transportation needs. Normally, it's accessibility. These are going to be in the center of population centers, often along busy commercial corridors, downtown urban core centers. And so accessibility and being able to actually get their delivery trucks into their facilities is a big issue here. Also reliability. A lot of times these are going to be very time sensitive, time critical shipments, whether it's documents or whether it's organ transplants, very, very time sensitive. They tend to be smaller, more frequent trips. And again, the most dominant modes here are truck and express package dependent, which means a lot of air cargo involved in support of the service industry. So with that kind of overview of the needs, what we're going to do next is present some generalized supply chains. And these supply chains really take a generalized view of some of the major industry sectors that you're going to find in practically every region throughout the country. And the thought behind this is that these supply chains, these generalized supply chains, can be customized for your specific region by interviewing and talking with some of your major shippers within these industrial sectors. So the first that we're going to look at is really a global supply chain, and this is the high tech. And the high tech industries really have some of the most global supply chains out there in terms of being far-flung and bringing in inputs from all over the world for manufacturing and distribution here in the U.S. One of the key points in this initial slide is the complexity of supply chain operations, especially in advanced manufacturing, and the reliance on the high service modes. This chain depicts a global supply chain for advanced manufacturing, specifically for the made-to-order production of high technology goods. The order for these goods, let's say, for example, laptop computers, start to production in Asia, which is where the fabrication of components take place. The components then reach the U.S. mainly by ship, but some of the critical components parts come by air. From the port of entry, they are moving primarily to factories where they are assembled into laptops. These factories also act as distribution centers. So you'll notice that we have a modal T down there where we have truckload and intermodal and then less than truckload. So the intermodal there is really referring to rail intermodal. We also have air depicted here, and then we have package. So you'll see that with these global supply chains and high tech, that they really are using a multimodal system and require upon that multimodal system. There are two other things happening in addition to these to the seaports and the manufacturing and distribution centers. And this is that there's a factory dedicated to the special high-end goods. It gets a lot of product by air, and it acts as a staging point for critical components. Again, those could be those components where the actual factories keep less than 2 hours worth of inventory on hand so that they can have those, you know, kind of an emergency stock. Second, there are general parts depot, which supply spare parts for repair services and upgrades. To the extent that our transportation system is becoming more and more unreliable and unable to meet the needs of just-in-time, what we're starting to see happen already is that a lot of our higher-tech manufacturers are increasing their emergency stock and expanding that two-hour worth of supply maybe out to 4 hours. And what this means basically is that they're becoming a little less competitive, but it can also translate to increases in consumer prices. So look at what happens as the assembled products move on to their end markets. The rail option drops out. You'll notice that you have the rail or the intermodal there from the seaport to the assembly. But as you move to the assembly and the DC into the consumer market, that rail drops out. And there you're seeing the less than truckload and the modes take over with, from your parts DC, you will also see some air shipments taking over there. The last thing to really notice here is the difference between the ownership and control. This is a very low inventory supply chain that assembles everything to order, and it keeps costs down further by not taking ownership of the goods until they actually reach the assembly plants or the distribution centers. However, the company also makes the commitment that computers will be delivered to the customer's door within a handful of days from the date of order. To meet this service commitment, the company takes control of the flow of goods and information starting back in Asia, and it manages the whole process of transportation and material flow itself. So the next supply chain that we want to talk about is, again, this is another global supply chain, but this is retail office. So this is one of the supply chains that's going to be far-flung, but it's going to have a very local end in terms of getting things out to the retail outlets. So the key point to this particular supply chain and slide is the blending of foreign-made with domestic products, both for supply of a full range of products to customers and for consolidation. In retail goods, the wholesale regional DC is the center of action. Supplies from domestic and international sources are being blended in the distribution center. So you'll see regional vendors there using truck and less than truckload packaging to get to the wholesale or regional DC. You're also going to have things coming in internationally through ports, and there they will use truck drayage as well as intermodal rail to get to the staging and to the distribution centers. And then you're also likely to have extra regional vendors as well, again, doing truckload and less than truckload packaging to kind of your emergency or your extra regional distribution center. Imports are typically containerized goods, and then from the port to the regional DC, this is mostly truck transportation. Rail is typically limited in this type of supply chain to the long distance hauling. And then rail is also limited since goods for multiple locations may end up consolidated within the same container. And it's just easier to do that from a trucking perspective. There are three notable characteristics of the retail supply chain. The multiple staging of goods, you have your initial warehouse and regional distribution, and then it goes to other warehouses via your truckload and your less than truckload packages, and then it goes to retail outlets. So it's also the overlapping relationship and supplies between distribution centers, as well as the way of serving end users with different kinds of trucking, which can involve full truckload deliveries or smaller deliveries in a multi-stop loop. And that's what you see there in your lower right-hand corner, is one of those multi-stop loops. Reverse logistics, which is where the industry, that's the industry term for return goods. So as they're dropping off new goods, they may also be picking up returned or defective goods. Is also a factor for retail supply chains. This creates two-way traffic, and if not scheduled properly, can result in even higher levels of trucks on the roadway. So today's logistics systems favor small orders. This can also mean small shipments, but if goods can be staged properly, located quickly, and moved fast, there are opportunities to consolidate loads and reduce the cost, as well as the truck trips, which is important from a public planning perspective. The blending of domestic with international products is one way volumes are combined. Distribution points can involve final stage manufacturing. For example, bulk paper might be put into smaller packages and have logos attached. This means value-added and employment benefits for the region's economy. So at some of these distribution centers, it's important to note that there's also the potential for these value-added type activities, stuffing and destuffing of boxes, but then also repackaging and tagging of the goods coming in from the containers. And so it's not just distribution employment that can be supported through these types of supply chains, but also value-added employment as well. Next, we're going to move on to the consumer beverages supply chain. And the first point in this regional chain is the interrelated roles of production facilities in order to create efficiency in manufacturing as well as in service to the markets here. And again, you'll see the red arrows are production flows, and the dotted purple-pinkish arrows are the production and warehouse flows. And then we have local receivers here. The facilities at the top have two roles, and the plants are also distribution centers. So you'll see a local plant and a distribution center. In this case, bottled products, we're looking here at consumer beverages, are made at one plant and canned products at another. So each plant ships to the other and acts as a DC for both products in its region. Notice that the modal key, and note that in the supply chain is distinguishing production flows from combined production and wholesale flows. All the freight carriage in this chain is done by truck. The company uses common carrier trucks to ship to external markets and a private truck fleet to distribute locally. The local delivery pattern is typical for urban freight. The private fleet trucks are of two primary sizes, typically 53-foot vans to deliver to high-volume locations like your Walmarts or your Sam's Clubs or Costco and grocery stores, and varieties of box trucks to deliver to smaller orders to like your convenience stores, your bars, and your restaurants and other retail outlets. So here, really talking about the use of stem routes there, you'll see where you have in production and wholesale flow. And the stem route is a cross-town travel to a delivery pocket where the driver spends the day making many stops in a small radius. Most notable about this chain is that all of this activity is time sensitive. Customers try to keep no more on hand than they expect to sell, and truck drivers are paid based on their delivered products. A lot of these outlets don't have a lot of warehouse space. They use all of their square footage for actual retail display, so they're not storing a lot of extra product. And again, the drivers here, in many cases, especially on those local markets, are also salespeople. So that puts some limitations on some of the typical operational solutions that folks think about for urban goods movements, such as off-peak deliveries. If the drivers are also the salespeople, the managers who are placing the orders and whom they're trying to sell typically work daytime hours, and so that makes off-peak delivery kind of a non-viable alternative there. Okay, so next we're going to talk about a high service chain. Since service industries are one of the fastest growing components of the nation's economy, we want to talk about a high service chain, and the example here is healthcare. The initial point on this is to recognize how how extreme time sensitivity of the product shipped in the hospital really creates a logistical challenge. Combine this fact with the fact that a lot of our medical centers are located in within the urban cores of our metropolitan areas. The fact that they're getting many, sometimes hundreds of deliveries a day, but also the fact that they're doing that within congested areas, and typically in older areas which may not have planned properly for the types of time sensitive deliveries in which these industries depend upon. The supply chain is designed for high service performance and the customer is a hospital, so having the right material on hand is critical. However, inventory costs money and space, so to keep healthcare costs down, it can't be wasted. The same could be true for other high service industries such as financial institutions, educational facilities, and other professional services. The first part of this slide establishes the situation. The hospital originally received goods directly from the vendors, but this was expensive and consumed storage space. So what it was is, they literally had hundreds and sometimes thousands of different vendors, each one making their own sales call and each one making their own delivery. And it took a lot of time, a lot of staff time, keeping inventory and placing orders with all these different vendors, but it also took up a lot of space. And any space storing goods and equipment was space that couldn't be used to actually sell medical services, which is the revenue generation. So now what happened, and this is an actual example from Vanderbilt University Hospital in downtown Nashville. So now what happens is the vendors ship to a central distribution center. So we have a third party that came up and said, okay, we'll be the distribution center and the vendors will ship to us. And then the hospital will make their direct order. They will order from the distribution center as opposed to all of the individual vendors. And so what's happened here is a multi-stage system. The central distribution center gets the product in volume for many customers, and then it stages it in consolidated loads to a regional distribution center that's close to the hospital. Again, time sensitivity is the key. So the vendors never have to go directly into the urban core or the urban center because the central distribution center would be located out on the fringe of the region. And then so all the vendors and the heavy traffic would be going into that one distribution center, and then they could take loads into the regional center that is then within a day's drive of the hospital to make those deliveries. So standard deliveries are made to ward floors every day, but emergency deliveries can still be made within 1 to 2 hours, because you'll notice there that there's also routes from those distribution centers that would allow 1 to 2 hour service and 4 to 6 hour service. Now, obviously, those facilities and locations would be holding much lower levels of inventory since they're just for emergency supply. There are many benefits of the system, but one, in terms of private sector benefits, the hospitals were able to convert storerooms to clinical use, thereby generating revenue. The wards are guaranteed supply because they're not waiting on individual vendors, but all of that is already within a central distribution center. And inventory costs are greatly reduced, and so are transportation costs. And this is all due to the efficiency of consolidation. All of this helps to keep the healthcare costs down. But there's also benefits to our transportation system in terms of reducing the truck traffic going in and out of busy urban cores, trying to make literally what could be dozens of deliveries a day. The entire system is exceptionally time sensitive, but it accommodates a range of performance requirements. And all of the transport is by truck, while air can be used for emergency. The system itself, in this particular situation, is engineered to avoid it, again, because it is very costly to do so. So it's a lot of information in a short period of time. I recognize that, but kind of pulling back and really thinking about, well, what are the implications of all of this private sector supply chain management and logistic trends, what are the implications for public sector planning? Well, I think we can start by understanding that first, when it comes to making, marketing, and distributing goods, today's business enterprises equate to the supply chain. The supply chain is the economic unit of competition. This means that the business unit isn't just a company, it's an interlinked chain. Second, business performance depends on transportation performance. and by extension, economic competitiveness depends on transportation performance. So, again, thinking about the sensitivity of supply chains to time delay and other disruptions all have implications for things like incident and congestion management. So the way in which we from the public planning sector can really manage incidents and help to mitigate congestion, we're going to have direct impacts upon the overall supply chain and the ability for private industry to effectively and efficiently manage those supply chains. The variability in the needs by chain, again, remember we talked about the different industrial sectors where some focused on low cost, others focused more on speed of delivery. This variation in the needs by chain has implications for where we on the public sector side, where we manage and where we invest. And you know, what are the freight demands and the needs put upon the system by the different industrial sectors. I think another thing, too, is the understanding that it was very obvious in all of these supply chains that supply chains and therefore freight movements cross jurisdictions. So the cross-jurisdictional nature or character of the chain has implications for how we on the public sector side should organize our planning efforts but also finance our investments. So I think that this slide, the purpose of this slide is to provide a linkage between the impacts of characteristics of the freight transportation system and private sector costs. And public sector freight planning has a direct linkage to economic competitiveness. The linkage between transportation and economic growth has been well documented, and freight is sometimes referred to as the economy in motion. FHWA's document from a few years ago, the National Freight Study, provides a detailed discussion of these linkages. And you know, both passenger and freight travel are important to economic growth, but freight mobility is especially important to the region's economy in terms of meeting the demands of industries and businesses and being able to really make sure that businesses, your local and regional businesses, can compete in this global environment. So when we talk about, you know, one of the costs impacting supply chains and competitiveness was travel costs and vehicle operating costs. Well, this can all be impacted by the level of service of your highway system. Inventory carrying costs is a huge factor in terms of economic competitiveness, and this is impacted by the reliability of your transportation system. Asset utilization costs in terms of you know, how many pickup and deliveries can you do in one day in terms in drayage. A lot of times this is influenced by land use and the interaction between land use and the transportation system. And then the access to markets, this is both to our input markets but also our final consumer markets, really requires multi-jurisdictional planning. So again, freight planning has a direct impact on the economic competitiveness of the nation, but also of every region throughout the nation. And finally, we'd just like to talk about, again, businesses compete on logistics costs. Freight mobility directly impacts the cost of doing business through logistics costs, and changes in information technology have led to an evolution in logistics and inventory management. The advances in information technology have led to a shift in control from material ownership to information ownership. This allows producers and distributors to reduce their inventory levels by relying on point-of-sale information and to drive ordering and production in as close to real-time as possible. Again, this is called pull logistics, which means that actual sales pull the product through the chain. The goal is to have exactly the right kind of product ready for purchase at exactly the right moment, but it does demand a high-performance transportation system to do so. So the evolution in information has had dramatic impact on how supply chain management depends upon the transportation system, and this is going to have dramatic implications for the demands that these freight stakeholders make on private sector planning process to make sure that their needs and concerns are being met. So with that, that concludes the formal presentation part of the seminar.
Thank you, Paul.